Hello, and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest for this week's podcast is Jennifer Knapp. Jennifer is a singer, author, and activist who recently released her latest album, Love Comes Back Around, her sixth album in a music career with two distinct sections. After releasing three contemporary Christian albums in the late 1990s and early 2000s, which garnered her two Dove Awards and a Grammy nomination, she took a break from music and moved to Australia before resuming her career in 2009. The following year, she came out as gay and released Letting Go, her first mainstream album. Set Me Free followed in 2014 in conjunction with the memoir Facing the Music, My Story. In this episode, we talk about her career in contemporary Christian music, vulnerability, and her own relationship with failure. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Jennifer Knapp, thank you so much for being with me on the Failing Boldly podcast.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
I so enjoyed and appreciated your autobiography, Facing the Music. And one of the things I loved about it was your vulnerability in the book. And you really, it doesn't seem like anyway, you hide a whole lot there. So I'm wondering, was it hard for you to be vulnerable in the book in the way that you did?
It wasn't hard. I mean, in a lot of ways, the ease of writing the book was because these stories that I decided to share were ones that kind of are the mile markers for me of what kind of shapes, you know, the way I understand the person I've been shaped into being by these experiences. So the choice was kind of already laid before me to decide to write the book. You know, that was the biggest decision, not in what stories I decided to tell, but when I knew that I was going to write the book, the decision to write the book, yes or no, was whether or not I was going to be willing to share these stories, because these are the stories that were pivotal to me. So in that sense, you know, there was this famous day in my household where I actually had a fight with my partner, because my partner's like, you know, you really should consider writing a book. And I just lost it. You know, it just turned into this epic fight, because, and it was this moment in time where I would absolutely refuse to do it. Just the terror of it and of being able to have to share that was this moment that, like, that I just turned aggressively outward to the person closest to me. And at the same, and then, interestingly enough, about 3 months later, when I started talking with Simon and Schuster, I was like, oh, of course, I'll write the book. And my partner was like, what in the world just happened? And, and I think it was just that pivotal moment of realizing that I had the choice to be able to share these stories. You know, I was very, I was very comfortable in my own skin and recognizing the moments that were vital and important to me. And once I made that decision, I think, to be able to share why those things were significant, because those personal things had a use outside of me, I think that was really inspiring to me to be able to share that. So, you know, on one hand, I've told these stories 1,000 times to people in the quiet room, you know, and over coffee and over beer. That's how, you know, you kind of generate your own narrative, is by telling these stories over and again. So it wasn't like I tried to keep them from anybody, because I always talk about them. But to be able to frame it in this, particularly in context of and why this book, you know, kind of focuses or centers around the controversy of my sexual orientation, I think that's why it became really important to be able to show that as, you know, the whole person and the whole narratives, and not just these singular events, disconnected as they are, whether they, you know, they be a moment of shame or a moment of failure. To me, it's like these kinds of things are what set the foundation for the whole person that you become. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I didn't mind at all sharing that process. It's, you know, and at the same time, you know, when you get to, there's the luxury of, you know, writing your own narrative in this way, is you get to choose those stories. Mm-hmm. So there's no, hey, like, it makes me think of like, you know, A Christmas Carol, where, you know, the ghost of Christmas past takes you back. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't actually get to see, you don't have, I'm narrating the event for you. So I realize that there's a certain point where you don't get to see all of that. And you're also getting my version of that story. But at the same time, there's, you know, there's a real risk in being able to do that and share that. And it was just one I felt like I was very much well prepared to take, because, you know, at the very least, they had meaning and purpose to me. And I think that that's what helps in those moments of vulnerability. You know, there's a stage in when we're vulnerable that's a very important thing. When we can see the use of that vulnerability, we can see the value of any failure or a moment of shame in leading up to our progress toward wholeness, I think is a major contributing factor to making vulnerability an easier thing to kind of open up the door to.
Mm-hmm. Did you find, as you got in the creative flow of writing the book, were you utilizing different parts of your own creative process compared to when you wrote music? Or did you find that it was pretty similar in the ways that you did both?
Yeah, you know, I think the major similarity for me was that I just deeply enjoy delving into the emotion and into the purpose and the meaning of events in my life. I don't shy away from that at all. I mean, I really do spend a disproportionate amount of my time thinking about, you know, what does this event mean? And to my soul and to the soul of others when we have these experiences. So that's a skill that I've been doing for better than close to 30 years. The form of music makes that, you know, it's a smaller form, right? It's 3.5 minutes per song segment. And then, you know, maybe 45 minutes when you look at a whole record, or an hour and a half when you look at narrating that into a concert. So the form kind of changes how you approach that. Creatives, we talk a lot about how the mediums that we use in art kind of do change that, the way that we function, the way that we tell that story, and what the product is at the end of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think by that nature, you know, when I sat down and I spent a lot of time literally in a van down by the river. I mean, I just took my laptop every single day to work on this book, and sat alongside the Cumberland River and just engaged in that same process, I think, that I do over a long period of time that ends up kind of collectively in a 3.5 minute song. I did that as a work every single day for like 12 hours a day for 6 months.
Wow.
It's as grueling as it sounds, but it's also, I think there was the reason why I mentioned the river is because there was a continuity to it, like a length to like sitting by the river every day as all of that passes by. I think there was some symbolic, there's kind of like this metaphor kind of living that I could look at to see how long and rich this type of story can be. And so I found it actually really quite liberating to get this extended space to be able to draw out all of these nuances that only show up in incremental pieces in my music.
Yeah.
And so I deeply appreciated that. And in its turn, I think what I realized is that it didn't short sell or shortchange the music that I'd done. I think for me personally, after having gone through the experience of writing the book, I actually started to appreciate how deeply and how long I've been carrying on this conversation in my music. I mean, I think even for myself, I would say, oh, it's just a 3.5 minute song. But then I realized that there's a lifetime of experience and emotion and spiritual growth that's reflected in every single second. Mm-hmm. And that's the joy, I think, that I wanted to express in longer form in the book, and saying, listen, yeah, we can do these we can look at this just incrementally, but we cannot forget how the rich fabric of that whole story intimately binds all of those moments together.
One of the things too about the book that I don't know if enjoyed reading is the right word, but my hunch is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when people talk about you now, there's usually right afterward, there's some sort of like, that's the Christian, contemporary Christian musician who came out or something like that. But in the book, you talk about your alcoholism, your parents' divorce, your less than glamorous life being a musician, and your coming out. And so I'm wondering, when people talk to you about the book or come up to you, do they immediately go to the fact that you came out, or are they also touched or moved or struck by the totality of your story?
You know, I think in being honest, I think that's the major appeal for most people to even pick up that book is because of the significance of my coming out story inside of Christian community. And so I don't resist that at all. And that's fine. But what I wanted to do, particularly because that's why so many people asked me to write that book to begin with, I didn't want to write just another story about struggling to come out in a conservative environment. I really purpose to write the whole story of what it means to see it, to paint a picture of the person and the kind of life that's impacted by one moment. It's a lot more than that. And so I think, yeah, people come to that as a starting place. And I think it kind of the story in that sense, I allow it to end there as far as, you know, the trajectory of the narrative. But I'm really grateful after like you're recognizing in that when people start to realize, oh, yeah, I picked up this book for that reason. And that's why it's motivating to me. But part of the reason why I think that people do find it the most encouraging is because of the longer story that's within it, to be able to say, oh, wow, yeah, it's not just this one minute moment in my life that is a conflict, you know, even within myself or to other people, but that it's the long story of who I am as a whole person and a whole being that really makes a difference. And that's what we really labor against, I think, when somebody points out a particular quality in the, you know, whether it's true or it's not true, whether, you know, if we have this particular conflict within ourselves or with the ways that other people view us, to realize that that moment is just a moment and it's the larger picture of the whole that we're actually really kind of trying to struggle against.
Yeah, absolutely. So my introduction to contemporary Christian music happened while I was in college. This is the late 80s. And I would kind of go back and forth in between for times really listening and times not. And I guess I never really gave a whole lot of thought to what the CCM industry was like. And so I was kind of taken aback. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was a little bit taken aback at the way that you describe your experience of the industry. I'm wondering if, and I don't know how much you think about it today or have conversations with people who are in it today, but as you describe it, there's a real veneer of perfection that seems to exist, or that's what they desire anyway, for the people who sing to have their lives all together. And that was one of the reasons that you really fought against that and kind of left the industry. I'm wondering, do you have a sense of that, if it's still that way today, or I don't know if you keep up with it to be able to comment on that.
You know, first I'll say is, yeah, I'm not really intimately aware of what's going on. And I suppose like the most critical thing I could say to that effect is that that there's like it doesn't beyond its field of influence or the people that are participating with it. I'm actually mildly disappointed that there's not a greater reach for people who are talking deeply about what it means to be alive and to be benevolent to themselves and in relationship with God and what that means to the people who are participate in it. And the fact that there's no impact, you know, the fact that I can easily ignore, you know, people, the artists that are doing that is indicative to me of something kind of, I don't know if I'd say wrong, mm-hmm. but I wish for more. You know, I wish to be compelled actually to listen, and I'm not. And granted, I'm busy and we all, you know, have seasons of where we're paying attention to such things or not. But I think, you know, with that criticism is part of the implied disappointment that I talk about with the book and that I still clearly carry today. I mean, I took very seriously the ability to share something amazing that I'd experienced in my relationship with God and the hope that I had in a community around me that was willing to share that. And I think that speaks to the power of not only that industry of itself, but because of the community and the understanding that we have and the responsibility that we have when we call ourselves Christian. I mean, that implies mm-hmm. that we're church, you know, that we're a collective body that cares not just about, you know, our individual relationship with God, but loving our neighbors and ourselves, and not just loving our church, but the wider community around us. So, you know, that I guess that's all to say is that, you know, I didn't I think it's really easy, and I think a lot of Christian musicians who have participated in, there's a lot for us to be critical of, because when you have such a high standard, you mm-hmm. inevitably fail it, right? But on the other side of it is that to continue to fail and to not progress in some way is all the more offensive. And I think that's where my criticism comes in. And I think that was part and parcel for why I didn't feel like I could contribute to an environment that wouldn't allow me to influence it to progress. And to really dive into those failures. I mean, like for me, you know, in kind of keeping with the theme of this podcast, like for me, failure is the most beautiful starting place of gain. And to, you know, at the core of understand, you know, that's right. The Christian narrative, right? Is to begin in the recognition of our human finitude. And, you know, our inability to reason and love our way out of our own despair is the necessity that compels us toward God, to understand that. And to me, to like, that's the underpinning of everything I do. It begins with an admission, and it moves out from there that says, I can and I will do and invest in being better. The short term is that, yeah, I think, you know, we can be really critical of industries like the Christian music industry or the church, but the longer story is what is the story that we tell in our failure? And I think that's where I just wanted to be able to go to a place where I was freely allowed to do that and not ruled by the commerce that said that, you know, one way or another that I had
right.
to kind
it seemed
of get
like
in line
the beginning of Cure that's the story or the narrative that you wanted to tell like, this is where I came from. My interaction with Jesus brought me to this place, and I want to tell that story. Were you surprised that people resisted you telling that early in your career?
I think what surprised me is that particularly inside of Christianity, I think what surprises me always is that the premise is, you know, that we start from this place of failure, this Augustinian, you know, we're corrupted in the soul kind of thing. I deeply understood that from the very beginning. What was beautiful about Christianity to me, and it continues to be today, is that there is hope for me to mm-hmm. move beyond that low place. So what surprised me was that this is the culture that we have every single day. It's the foundation of where we start. And yet every time I felt like I made a move in my own life to discovering my own dignity, to discovering my own worth, it was the propensity. In Australia, we have a saying of cutting down the tall poppy. Every time you kind of get your head above water, somebody would kind of try and think that it was a good Christian duty to humble you. So it's this strange paradox of not wanting to, you know, to outlive one's lowly station for fear that we're not being humble when in fact what we should be doing is being able to find and celebrate the dignity of our self-worth.
You talk about failure quite a bit in the book. At least by my count, there were at least about 8 different mentions of failure. There may have been more that I missed. And I wanted to read a couple quotes from the book that I really enjoyed. One is, you're describing, and I don't know if you call this a philosophy or an attitude in Australia, called fair dinkum. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah. Yeah. Very well done. Fair dinkum, yeah. Right?
And so here's a quote from your book. You said, in many ways, to make excuses, to fail to try, is practically an insult to the very idea that all things are possible, which I really appreciated, of course. And then also, you later on in the book, you talk about having a conversation with a plastic surgeon in Australia, and you went in to have a couple of moles removed.
That's utterly fantastic.
And then you have a couple of different, or you have a conversation with him. And then here's another quote when he had talked, he'd asked, he said, all you can do is be your honest best. And then you responded, and I'm quoting here, but I had done my best and it wasn't good enough. I doubted, I pined, I prayed, and I was still me. I was a gay woman inspired by Jesus in ways beyond my ability to communicate, who failed to live up to the expectations of all that a Christian was supposed to agree with, believe in, and reenact. There's a lot there.
Do you
yeah, just put it in one big run-on sentence.
Sure. Do you, I guess, what's your relationship with failure now? And has it changed over the years at all?
My first answer is no. My relationship with failure, I absolutely adore. Like, as I've clearly pointed out, I think that's a starting place. And, you know, I think that's part of like it's probably reminiscent of not only Christianity, but, you know, my experience with alcohol abuse. It's like, man, you cannot begin to get yourself straightened out until you admit where you are realistically. And, you know, that's not just Alcoholics Anonymous or Christianity. I mean, that's a long line of human history saying admission is the first step. So my relationship with failure, I love it. Like, it's an MO that I have adopted in my life. And I cannot imagine living without. However, what I have, I think if there's a new bit of that information in recent years, it's a better understanding of how to weed out the differences between what is failure and what is not. You know, and I think as a perfect example, I think for in my own life as a gay person in a Christian community, you know, my sexual orientation was very much and still is by many conservative people defined as a failure to live up to God's heterosexual perfection. And I believe that for a very long time. And what made that so difficult was because I believed that was a failure. Because it's a strange paradox to know something about yourself, which is inherent, you know, undeniably true. Like, wow, this is a fact of life. Like, I am attracted to somebody of the same sex. I can't will myself to change it. This seems to be written in my DNA, although it's a mystery to me. This is a fact. So if this is beyond my control, how do I label this a failure? Because what you inevitably fail is to succeed in denying something inherently true about yourself, right? So, so being able to weed out what is failure and what is not was probably the next big life lesson for me in my relationship with failure. Because it's very risky, I think, if you're a person like me who depends on those moments of failures to speak to you and generate wisdom and progress for you to a certain extent, adjudicating what failure is very important to be able to honestly assess where you need to grow. Because, you know, if in one sense I had said, found a way for the label of my sexual orientation to be accurately fitted as a failure, the healthy person that I am today would still be waiting to be realized. I'm absolutely convinced of that. And not just in my own testimony, but by the testimony of thousands upon thousands of other LGBTQ people who have lived in the closet and found liberation by acknowledging it, what is true about themselves and separating that out from a heterosexual failure.
I can't remember if you talked about this, I mean, as far as a specific moment in the book, but I'm wondering, did you have an epiphany, kind of the Lady Gaga moment of I was born this way and then everything shifted? Or was it gradual when you came to realize that my attraction to this other woman is not failure, it's part of who I am, and I embrace it?
Yeah, I don't know if there's an epiphanal a moment of epiphany for me. I think there have been moments where I have decided to decisively move in one direction or another, but I don't know that if, you know, the way that I've kind of conceived the things in those moments was anything more than an act of faith, you know? And I think I kind of address that a little bit when I talk about like the decision, how much of a specter my sexual orientation was in me turning back and continuing to participate in music after having so much time off. I mean, I realized in coming back to music that like it was probably an inevitability that I was going to be talking about my sexual orientation on a public level. There was just, in being honest with myself, I just knew that there was no way I was going to be able to keep that secret, nor nor did I want to live in something that denied it. So it didn't, you know, which is all to say is I had an immense fear of doing that, but I decided to do it anyway. Because I believed somewhere in there that I hadn't failed by my sexual orientation, but I was waiting for that. You know, if in making that decision, then I followed up with an action that tested it. That I wasn't going to stop progressing no matter how foolishly each following step would be. I wasn't going to stop, that I was going to continue to kind of move ahead and move forward. And so it wasn't an epiphany that said, oh, I don't know, you know, I don't know that I had that. I think it's just been gradually building stone upon stone upon stone until all of a sudden, you know, and it's almost like it's a lateral building, right? Like in a foundation of a house, you don't just build one stone vertically. You need a base. And so each one of those kind of moments, I think, kind of contributes to that and into the wider thing. So they're incremental. Just I remember one day where I was on the campus of I was actually in Lynchburg, Tennessee, not too long after I'd come out, and I was participating in an LGBT inclusive worship service in Lynchburg, and a few Liberty students had come over to participate in that, but kind of on the down low. Like they were really nervous to be there, very much. And several had kind of gotten around, were talking to me and saying, yeah, if they would have found out that they were there supporting this event, they would have had demerits given to them as students that would have counted against their standing somehow or other in the school. And so it was a real risk for them to be there. And I was like, this is utter bullshit. Like it just, it enlivened something in me that I understood that I was always really afraid at that point to kind of say out loud that I was or I wasn't a Christian. And that offense of thinking that offense kind of lifted something up in me where I went right over the campus, stood on the campus and did a video blog really quickly. And it was the first time, I think, since my coming out in public that I claimed my faith, that I stood on the campus and said, There are entities out there. There are people out there saying that I'm not legitimate in my faith because of my sexual orientation. I'm going to stand right here and dare you to throw me off. You know, that says that these two things aren't legitimately bound. And so that, you know, it wasn't like I had like some treaties built up before that. It was just like those little moments like that where you realize that. Sure. So, it's not an epiphany. It's just a moment where you have the courage to be able to kind of act out, I think, what's been welling up inside of you.
And it ties in a little bit to my next question about what has kept you, or what keeps you persevering, what keeps you resilient, both now and in the past years when you've had moments of obstacles or failure or whatever. And it sounds like at least one of those answers is a little bit of righteous anger, utilized in a good way. And so I'm wondering, are there other things that you could name that have helped you persevere over the years?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm kind of narcissistic. I mean, I say that laughing. There's something really healthy about it, I think, in the sense that there's always something that kind of seems to generate it. There's like this pattern, I guess, is what I mean to say. Is somewhere in there, there's an individual experience that I've had, you know, that in terms of my own Christianity and the way that I approach and talk about how I think that my church should theologically respond to people in general, like regardless of difference. But, you know, how I build my theology today has a lot to do with how I entered into Christianity and understood my own experience. And it's really selfish in its beginning, right? You're trying to figure out who you are inside of the scope of this broader picture. And as that kind of gets solidified, and you discover how important the truths are that you experience in those occasions, and what a blessing it is to have discovered such truths, it compels you forward. I mean, so my own experience, if you take my LGBTQ experience into that framework, is, yeah, it was intensely personal. Like it was all about covering my own ass. Like I needed to survive as a human being inside of that. And it didn't really matter about the rest of the world. But having survived that and learned from that and discovering what a blessing that is, it now can propels me forward to do the work that I do in advocacy. I'm doing that work in advocacy, and I'm also taking another turn and doing both. So I'm working on a wider social scope, but I realize that what I want to do in the social world is limited by some of the theological knowledge I have. So in turn, I'm going back and working some bit on myself and, spending time and going through divinity school and getting my master's in theological studies and still care so I can continue on with excellence, this goal that I have of being able to be, what Henry Nouwen talks about in Loneliness to Solitude. Henry Nouwen talks about this idea that we do intimately this work in these lonely, what seems like a lonely place, but it's actually the work of solitude. And once you do that and affirm that work in that, place of solitude, it compels you out to community. And to me, that's just an immensely amazing testimony of what it means to be connected to something of the spirit. I think that it does the work in the individual soul, but it compels us to do that outward. So for every one of those moments that, if you're lucky, you're kind of doing all these works combined at the same time, right? For the little thing that you've kind of conquered in some way or have some level of mastery of you, it compels you out to work and share that with others. But out there in that new space, you also get a new thing to work on. So you're now working on some other thing while doing that other work. And they're just kind of constantly fueling each other. And it's something that I really deeply appreciate. And I'm grateful to have it, because if that cycle wasn't working, I'd just be playing PlayStation all day long. And it would be a waste of a life, because I really love PlayStation.
Well, you've touched on this already a little bit. How today would you describe your faith?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I still don't know how to answer that question. I mean, it's a compelling, I have this compelling force that I don't know if I would say it's inside of me or that I'm connected to. I mean, part of the reason why I hesitate is because I still haven't reframed the old language that I have. I mean, in the book, I talk about just how amazing this kind of experience was in coming to understand Christianity and coming to understand the value and the dignity of my life, and how that was a moment of absolute salvation of which, I don't know, it's mysterious to me and how much that feels beyond my control and how I feel held by an external force, which I call God. Mm-hmm. And the language at which I understand that is very Christian language. However, at the same time, as I'm already kind of displaying, it's deeper than just simply calling it Christianity. It's deeper than that orthodoxy or the practice of religion does on the surface. I think those things, I think our orthodoxies and our theologies and the practices and the rituals and the participation that we do, I think those things can lead us toward that, but they are not the same. You can, to me, it's like a very different, it's like a math. I love the Gospel of Matthew because of how Jesus talks about the difference between you can follow the letter of the law, right? Mm-hmm. You can do all of these things to the letter and look perfect and you can execute well, but it's the spirit that really drives their fruitfulness. Mm. I'm abiding by the law when I don't murder someone, right? Mm-hmm. But because I haven't murdered someone does not mean that I've loved them well. And it doesn't mean that I've caused them to prosper. And I think somewhere in there, there's that analogy that I have in my faith is that, I don't want to, and that's why I say I'm spiritual, but not religious, which is so boring at this point, because that's what everybody says now. But I think it, at the same time in saying that, there's a real loss in the depth of what my faith in God teaches me and why I continue to look within my tradition of Christianity to try and discover that.
Well, there's a depth when you say spiritual, in that context, I mean, I think some folks talk about spiritual, but not religious, and they don't really know what that means. They kind of know vaguely what it means, but it sounds like you are really wanting to go a lot deeper when you say spiritual and really exploring and looking and doing the hard work of figuring out what that means?
Well, I think part of it is a recognition that, you know, when I talk about spirit, I'm probably going to sound really mystic, but when I talk about spirit, what I really do think is I'm an organism. I'm part of a living organism, right? That I'm not just, it's not just a spiritual practice as in, you know, saying a mantra or aum or creating some vibration in the universe. It's a living organism. I'm a part of that extension. I'm a tendril. I'm a capillary. I'm vital to whatever end it is that I'm on of being a force that not only is, you know, having something speak into my being, you know, from a distant place and allowing me to live and prosper, but moving through me and allowing that to further extend out. That to me is an extraordinary notion. And it's, you know, religion, like in the history of human religion, for the people who understand that with whatever language they use, I think that's what continues to deeply compel me toward a faith where I would say most days undoubtedly that I believe in God. It's very difficult. There are days that I don't. And then at the same time, I say there are absolutely days that I don't. There are days that I'm bewildered by and frustrated and want to be an anarchist to religion and organized religion. Some days that I'm agnostic and other days that I'm an atheist. Yet each one of those processes are like, you know, these little momentary failures that seem to just keep compelling me in my own inquiry to not be the dead end. Like there's just something out there that I want to be a part of and that I sense that I'm a part of. And this is the language that I currently have the capacity to use to be able to express that.
Can you talk a little bit about the Inside Out Faith Foundation and what you hope to accomplish with it?
Sure. So Inside Out Faith Foundation is, for the most part, is an expression of LGBT advocacy, right, and faith inclusion. For LGBTQ inclusion in faith communities. So the goal of that is to actually not necessarily be in a defensive position, but actually act that out. So In much the same ways that I've had as a personal experience in, you know, not necessarily defending myself as an openly gay person of faith, but actually living it out and doing that and equipping that. And so we want to be part of that story and part of that narrative. And that's driven a lot from this experience that I've had and realizing that, you know, the story that I've been able to share with community has had an impact in allowing other people to help, you know, regenerate their own, you know, not regenerate, to have the courage to dig into their own stories and tell their own stories. So, you know, I'm not out to necessarily change the theology of any one faith tradition that isn't inclusive of LGBTQ people. What we aim to do is actually tell the tradition to show how compatible and how vital and important religious participation is in establishing whole and healthy, well-rounded human beings when it comes to their sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, Jennifer, I will wrap it up with this. I usually ask folks to talk about or tell a failure story of their own. And so I don't know if one has popped into your mind, whether it is from your professional or personal life. It can be something huge or something small. But I'm curious about any kind of failure story you could share with us.
Yeah, you know, on the spot, you know, I'm going to cheat a little bit and tell a bit of an anecdote that I share in my book. For me, there was a pivotal moment for me when I was in an autograph line. I wasn't in the autograph. I'm the subject of the autograph line. So everybody's lining up and, you know, I'm the amazing diva, which everyone's clamoring for. And I cannot express to you the chaos of an autograph line in my heyday. I mean, it was just insane. And through all this stuff, we're just basically cattle calling and trying to push really excited teenage kids through. And on one side, you know, on one side of it, you know, it's an honor and privilege that somebody would be so compelled to want to meet you. And then it's a utter tragedy that all you ever do is like just sign a book and say, you know, congratulations, move on. You know, it's like a bad scene out of The Christmas Story where he's like, ho, 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 okay, like move it on. But all that to say is on one of those days, this young woman comes up to me and whispers in my ear, you know, thank you so much. You know, your music has saved me from a life of homosexuality. And it was a moment for me because I think looking back, if I'm honest, I know that people already suspected me of being gay, even though I hadn't really kind of sought that out for myself. But I knew that there was a tension point there, and I knew the significance of this, why this girl would whisper it and why she would look for resources that encouraged her to be not gay, right? That she would look for resources that encouraged her and made it possible for her to be accepted among her community. And so as she whispered this to me, I knew all of that, and I didn't say anything. It was just the worst moment for me because I really wanted to say something. And instead what I did was chose to kind of serve myself. I chose to not, and there were like, that was a moment, but there were a thousand other moments like that, that I repeated again and again and again. And this was a moment that was intimately attached to me that made me realize, you know, hey, do you see what you're doing here? Right. This was a moment that put a spotlight on me and said, this matters deeply to people, how you affirm them when they're in a space of conflict. And I signed her thing. I pushed her on out the door, and for years and years and years, never even broached the subject. In fact, I'd made a decision that, you know, I wasn't going to say anything about sexual orientation on the public sphere because I knew that I wouldn't have a job, regardless of my own sexual orientation, that it would, you know, it would put me in jeopardy of not being able to succeed to have a liberal thought as a Christian. And that moment of failure was long-term. Like I said, it those little micro failures happened again and again and again. And I recognized with increasing severity the impact of every time one of those happened. It's, you know, like one of those moments that happens and you repeat it again and again and again until it's so loud in your ears and so obvious to you that you have to decide whether or not you're going to be a failure, like, you know, that you're going to acquiesce and that you're going to submit to whatever that failure is, or that you're going to do something about it. And so that was, you know, I think that probably happened somewhere around, my guess would be in 1999, 2000. By 2002, I would have told, when I left Christian music, those kind of micro failures had increased to the point where I quit the Christian music industry. And I tell you this absolutely in saying that I viewed myself as having quit for all of the things that I wanted my faith to be and to pass along, and the joy that I knew that I was a person of dignity and worth and a supreme value to God. That at that day when I latched up my guitar cases, I knew that I had said, no, I will not do this work anymore. And for 7 years, I lived in that until one day, just like I said, kind of starting out of the selfish seed of just not wanting to be a failure to that end anymore, I began to get back up. But it took a very long time to tell that story.
And you continue to tell it today. So the book that we've been talking about is called Facing the Music, and it's still available in all kinds of different places. And then your latest album is Love Comes Back Around. And so folks can go to your website and learn more about that. But Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. And thank you for the multiple and creative ways that you're still doing your ministry and advocacy.
My deep pleasure. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about a subject that's actually near and dear to my heart. So thank you.
That's this week's episode. Thanks again to Jennifer Knapp for speaking with me. You can learn more about her music and the Inside Out Faith Foundation at her website, jenniferknapp.com. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast, as my next conversation is with the author Jonathan Eig, whose recent biography on Muhammad Ali made numerous best of lists in 2017. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.